A podcast? All about the curse of Oak Island? Fans around the world say yes.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. You are listening to the Oak Island Podcast. And of course, we're here to talk The Curse of Oak Island, everybody's favorite TV show. We're talking season 10, episode 23, The Italian Job.
How you doing?
And of course, if you dig what we're doing here, you can find us on all major podcasting platforms. Hit that subscribe button. We try to drop every Monday for you, wherever you find your podcasts. And of course, if you want to hashtag get to the bottom of something, check out the website, theoakislandpodcast.com. Right there, you can check out all the episodes. You can see some of the interviews we've done, our social media links, and even on the episode pages themselves, there's usually some cool rabbit holes to chase down. That is theoakislandpodcast.com.
Oh, that's a good idea.
I am Jer. I'm here with my buddies, Mikey and Billy. And as I said, we're wrapping up here, boys.
This getting is there. Close. Getting close.
Italian Job, episode 23. Fall is rapidly approaching. Mikey, we've enjoyed many a fall here in Michigan. The leaves are turning on the show. The leaves are turning here as well. How are you, sir? And what are you drinking?
I am doing well. Ciao.
Ciao.
Buongiorno.
Ciao, Miguel.
Ciao. I'm doing good. I'm doing good. Wrapping it up. Seasons are changing. It is getting to be football. It's football weather, you know? All right. You guys ready to hear what I'm drinking tonight?
Sure am.
I went out of the state of Michigan.
He left.
First time in a while.
I can't remember you going outside of the state frequently for your brew choice.
And I went to a state that I typically would not go to.
Idaho.
I love Idaho.
I'd much rather go to Idaho than this state.
I just don't see Mike's in Idaho a lot.
Let's not cause another civil war and alienate any of our listening audience out there.
It's that state to the south. It's Ohio. Foreign territory for me.
Okay.
Across that border.
Oh my gosh.
You know, it had to try it out.
Many listeners in that four-letter state.
Yes, actually there is. Columbus is actually a big city that listens. So shout out Columbus.
What did you get out of that state?
All right, so I got a Great Lakes Brewery.
All right.
It's in Cleveland, and it is the first brew pub and microbrewery in Ohio.
Really?
Learned that, yep, as I did a little research on it. But I got the Dank Demon. It's an IPA, so I'll be getting to the bottom of that this evening for the Italian Job.
Nice. Good choice. I'm gonna jump in here. I mean, I don't have a beer from a city where the river caught on fire, anything that exciting. Look into that little history there for Cleveland, where your brewery is. But hey, it's great to be back. We are definitely getting down the stretch here. Horses are seeing the finish line in sight. I think there's three left with tonight's episode of season 10, episode 23, The Italian Job. I'm going back to a beer tonight, boys, that I have had a few times, but I'm trying to stick in the state of Michigan here for the last few episodes. Going back to Founders, it's a frequent one. The Dirty Bastard is back.
Nice.
In tonight.
It's a staple.
But they changed the label art. The Scottish guy's gone from the label. He's just disappeared.
Yeah. We used to know the guy that did the old artwork with some of the changing they had at the guards there. They've commissioned a lot of new artwork, the labels. I used to be on the six-pack, actually.
That's right.
There's me on the Centennial. Sure. My wife was on there. But, they've changed the artwork, going with a new look, you know, Mad Men. If you've ever seen the show, it's all about advertising. Yep.
Love that show.
Catch the eye. Apparently, well, I was not eye catchable.
They took the dirty bastard off this bottle, and they took that bastard off Centennial. Or I'm sorry, Jer, off that label of Centennial there.
Yeah. It's a whole new thing. I liked, of course, I'm biased. I actually have behind me here one of the old school ones. I mean, I realize we are in audio, but in my little office podcasting station, I do have, let me see that. That's me there.
On a six pack of the Founders Centennial old school version.
IPA, yeah.
It's famous. No big deal.
Any relic hunters out there, go on the search. You can see our Mr. Jer here on the box.
No big deal. Yeah,
what are you drinking tonight then, sir, before we jump into the Italian job?
Well, I tell you, I'm going to give a shout out. I was just out with the wife at a great place here in Grand Rapids called Meat Barbecue. They were actually featured on, forgive me if I get the title wrong, but it's like Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives.
Dives.
I think that's what it is.
It's in Grand Rapids?
Meat Barbecue is indeed in Grand Rapids, and often on the History Channel, you'll see that Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, if that is indeed the alliterated name. But they were featured on there, and I went there just before the show and had from Evil Genius, entitled Stacy's Mom, is an IPA. So I don't know if you guys have had Stacy's Mom.
She's pretty got good. It going on.
Pretty, pretty, pretty good.
She's dealing in the meats tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Hey.
Well, I'll have to check that place out.
Yeah, Meat Barbecue.
It's local.
Fantastic. Yeah. Fantastic stuff. I highly recommend. And it's, you know, if you go, the nachos, which is not something you would think to have, but it's like fresh-made chips, all this meat on top of it. Also, the poblano and Dooley egg rolls are fantastic. And then you get the... Yeah, and then you get the meat platter is what I get, and I go with the Black Magic. Get the Black Magic sauce.
That's about four heart attacks right there.
Forget about it.
Let's jump into season 10, episode 23.
Let's get to the bottom of it, guys.
Oh, boom. The Italian job. Mr. Peter Frenetti. I swear he's starting to resemble a young Indiana Jones there, maybe. We've got an imposter, but he's calling over this whole road trip, summoning them over into a corner of an old church in Italy for a shocking discovery. What is so shocking, Mr. Peter Frenetti? What are you finding over there?
He's on it.
Laird, the true Indiana Jones, Niven, and the archaeologist crew, they're digging away at that well area on Lot 5, so what have they turned up? And someone apparently dates another old piece or another old artifact. Let's just see what that may bring for a few comments from our team here. And finally, boys, the bottom of the garden shaft. I'm ready. Are you? Are you ready to get to the bottom of that? Well, Rick and Marty are too, and it's about time we see what's down with that. So, fellas, as we start seeing the horizon here, something over the horizon, end of the season, you know, there's just a few things remaining here that we've got in season 10 for us to discuss. And as always, you got to keep in mind that in this world, there are three kinds of people. Those who can count and those who can't. So let's go. Wish me love, oh, wishing well, the kiss and tell.
What's the third one?
What do you mean? That was all four.
All right, so hold on. Are we going to do this every episode now where you have dad jokes at the beginning of each episode?
Or what sometimes? Do you mean are we going to do this now? This has been happening for years. I think we got to carbon date that bit there.
Sometimes I'm sitting there and the wind's blow behind into the sails of dad jokeness.
I love it.
Sometimes it goes down the historical trail or it goes into the proverb trail. And this one, I've been sitting there and I'm caught up in the winds of dad jokeness.
I love it.
What I also love seeing here is Mr. Charles Barkhouse Beard. He's rocking out in the intro in the garden shaft.
Charlie Tree Cabin.
Seasonal beards.
Letting it go towards the end of this season. Marty, Charles, Craig, and Dumas Contracting. They're all standing at the lip of that hole up there with Charles Barkhouse about to go into the hole. They're at 82 feet, they confirm, at the bottom here. But again, weather is rapidly closing in. Our friend Mr. Robert Clotworthy confirms it's been 5 months since Dumas Contracting started this project. So what in the world do you think Charles thinks he's going to see when he gets down there? I wonder.
Right.
He does say he wants to be the first one down there. So, fellas, roll with me for a minute here. If indeed Mr. Barkhouse, Charlie Tree Cabin, he's the inside guy, we think, right?
Right.
Why are you letting him go down first?
Exactly.
In all seriousness, this guy, this means the world to him. He leads tours there on Oak Island. He's been involved for his life. But if he's a Sith, why are you letting him down there before anybody else?
It's like he's got Jedi mind tricks over him.
Oh, everybody.
Right.
Well, I just wanted to make sure that was noted here, because he does get to go climb down there first. It looks awesome. He looks to get emotional for a moment there, or maybe he was out of breath from the long stair climb. Either way, you know.
I'll take either one, yeah.
He was reflective on it. You can see also that the corner is sinking down a bit, as they've been discussing here. So you can actually see it with your own eyes now as Charlie's down there. And this is going to allow them additional maneuvers to go explore and go poke around and look for that tunnel down there somewhere. And Marty does say, before we pull out of the garden shaft here, this is a utility. The whole shaft was just a setup or a vehicle to be used as the main access to go put out these probing holes towards a tunnel or the baby blob area. So definitely it's like the mothership's ready to now deploy out the probes to go see what's out there.
It's what we've been waiting for, is them to get to the bottom of the shaft and start poking around.
It is.
So let's poke around a bit, like, especially on what that is, it the northeast corner of it where the shaft goes through the baby blob area, and
northwest.
Yes, correct. Northwest.
And that's where it's sinking.
Yes.
At that northwest corner, and they mentioned north a few times there. That's where it's sinking. Obviously, if it's sinking, there's ground isn't stable below, i.e. I'm going to infer there's a tunnel, as we all have been doing. And, you know, we talked about this a while ago, and even Marty says that I'm going to physically go underground in the money pit. That's a quote. I'm physically going underground in the money
pit.
So we've brought this up before in past Oak Island podcasts, that on the show The Curse of Oak Island, they have sort of been dropping the garden shaft and interchangeably been saying money pit, and Marty indeed says,
right,
I'm physically going underground in the money pit.
That's a very big jump. It's a big jump, though, really. That the garden shaft to me was its own entity. The money pit was still a mystery. As the season has progressed, indeed, as you just said, Jer, they're now one and the same, and I think in a couple more episodes here we only have left, it just becomes the money pit. I wish it's a very bold statement. It's a bold
I'm hoping it becomes the treasure vault.
There it is
what they start referencing it as.
And now about this, it hasn't been brought up in a while. We all along have been like, what if the treasure is under that memorial to the
bam,
and there they are, they're under the ground now, where we've said all along
this that
would be wild.
Like, it was kind of half joke, but half like, but this was years ago we brought this up, and we even did a little research as to what the thing was.
Right.
And
we even broke down that conversation, though, of, hey, what are all those rocks together that generally on the top of the screen, they were nowhere near digging it. Nope. What are those women of Oak Island hiding out there?
The
answer was there the whole time.
Oak Island podcast knew it.
Let's go over to Rome. Italia, the road trip crew. Emiliano Sacchetti
Biscotti
is back. And Doug, Rick, Peter, and Alex meet up with him, as well as a rival numismatist, Umberto Maruzzi, to review the Roman half coin and the lot 7 metal piece that they had discovered, the rectangular piece with really no clear identification, I believe, up to this point. But we've got a rival numismatist here. I wonder if Sandy's got some competition going.
Right. Yep. Foreign guy here.
Yeah. Umberto does confirm and agree. This is a 4th century Roman coin. He compares it immediately to another example he has in his shop, but he's got the whole coin version in his shop.
That was wild.
That was so awesome to compare what they found on Oak Island to a really good condition coin that you can see the outlines if it were rubbed down on Oak Island. So very awesome to see an immediate comparison of, oh, you've got that. I've got the whole thing here.
Umberto's got it all.
He's got it rolling over there. The metal piece is not a coin, though. So they've got, you know, this other rectangular piece. It's not a coin. It's bronze. It's ancient. It's 1,000 years old. Umberto believes it's a weight used for counterfeit metal use to compare against real coins and fake coins. They should weigh that amount. So think of the old scales of justice lady.
Right.
Justice is blind. She's holding the scale there. Well, that's what they're using these coin or this piece for, this rectangular piece. And then he says the weight of the rectangular piece they have in his shop from Oak Island matches the weight of a Byzantine coin with the image of Christ on it. And he then produces that coin as well, saying, this is perhaps a coin you would verify using this metal rectangular piece. And if the two balanced out on a scale, then it was valid. Awesome coin he just has sitting there in his Byzantine imagery of Christ on that is impeccable. It's so detailed.
I mean, how many people do you think carried around a trade weight like that to check to see if stuff was phony or not? I mean, it doesn't seem like everyone would have one. To me, it seems like someone in power, someone doing a lot of
verification.
Yes, would have something like this.
Tax guy, accountant.
The headmaster.
And I wonder, like, he knew it was exact for this region. I mean, I wonder how common that was for you to do back then if you were on the cusp of two empires. If there were people like that needed to have these tokens of exact weight to determine the currency. I'm sure there was fluctuations in weight differences and lots of people trying to make a coin, make a buck, and you would need something like that. I thought that was interesting.
And how many people are walking around with fake currency back then?
Got some phony balonies out there.
Right.
Man. Well, the team's going to go off, and they are introduced with Emiliano's connections to Professor Andrea de Robilan. He's a professor, author, researcher. He's with the American University in Rome. You know, Rick has proposed that there's been some pre-Columbian voyages to the New World here. And this gentleman, Andrea de Robilan, has for 40 years been speaking and writing on this very subject.
That's some history there.
Absolutely. A wealth of knowledge.
Hard work he's put in. I mean, 40 years, that's a lifetime for someone.
Absolutely. Well, he's jumped into a little booklet here, he notes, from 1558 out of Venice. This little booklet talks about two sailors in the 1390s. I think they were brothers. Mm-hmm. They sailed out of Venice to the North Atlantic. Once they reached the North Atlantic, you know, an area such as Scotland, Ireland, England, somewhere in there, he was taken to the local leader, Mr. Henry Sinclair, the Scottish nobleman.
Yeah.
How about Hank?
Hank Sinclair. That's a name that pops up. That's very familiar.
Yeah. His friends know him as Hank. Henry, Sir Henry Sinclair.
And I think our friend of the podcast, author, Mr. James McQuiston,
has
definitely provided some information on Henry Sinclair, who was a Scottish nobleman and leader, and so connected to Nova Scotia's history. Well, anyways, back to these brothers quickly here. They stay with Sinclair. They work for him for 10 years. They write about the places they went. And in 1558, there's material published of a map on this voyage as well. So they go on a voyage, they make this map. Then in the late 17th century, another map that he has identified references this one of the brothers from 1390, Antonio Zeno. So it's proof that in the late 1300s, 1390, in this theory, it's proof that Antonio Zeno, one of the brothers, makes a map from the New World out of Nova Scotia. And then in the 17th century, somebody else makes a map and references this was the guy that discovered it in 1390. It's before 1492.
That's some cool research.
Yeah, it gives validation, I think, to Zena's theory, for sure, which had the map that's often been called into question, which has a pre-Columbian date on the map, which that year has also lined up with some other things. But I certainly think Rick welcomed this idea. A lot of people welcomed it because of the affinity we have for Zena and the research she's done. And the idea that people knew about the New World before.
Right, before Columbus.
Yeah, sure. Which I think is pretty well established. I mean, we've got lots of different things on the History Channel, and I forget the name of the stone in Minnesota, which is still surprising. Like, it's I feel like we're on taboo ground sometimes when we say there's this map of North America from these Venetian boys, the Zeno brothers, you know, at 1390. I feel as though it is true, and I think more of this should be welcomed. This knowledge should be welcomed by modern sort of archaeologists and modern scientists.
Agreed. Even if it rewrites history, I'm fine with that.
Yeah, that he discovered. They're basically saying that he discovered Canada, or maybe not discovered, but he was in Canada, knew of Canada in 1490.
Yes. You the know? Kensington Stone is what you reference, the rune stone in Minnesota, right? Stone.
Correct. Yes. Which in Minnesota, certainly
older than
it's authenticated, older than pre-Columbian for sure.
And don't forget what Nova Scotia translates to in, I think, Scottish, right?
New Scotland. Can I tell you guys today, didn't have any plans on discussing this, but I love going to auctions on random, whatever they're going to auction out where I live. It can go from absolutely high bidder here. But I was randomly walking around just today, and I looked down, and sometimes you find some gems there, right? I found it looked like a homemade piece of wood cut out, and it had Canada, like, and scribbled right in the middle of it, and somebody made a clock out of this piece of wood, but on every spot where the hour would be was a province of Canada. And I looked down and the first province I see is Nova Scotia. Woo. And I took a picture of this, and we'll put it on the website here.
Sweet.
The nice symbol for it is the Scottish lion that is so connected to Scotland. And right there I went, I know that I'm going to be talking about this today on our episode here. And I look down and I see the Scottish lion. Definitely, there's got to be something there.
You bid on it?
No, they took it away from me for $3. I let it go into the wild.
Man, let it go, for $3, you let that ride?
I got the picture. That's all I needed.
That's true.
You know,
that's true.
Interesting you say that. I just saw this post that a guy at an auction got this really early clock with the same kind of markings on it, and it ends up being it was worth six figures.
Right.
So, I don't know if that's it's funny. I'm just saying it's interesting how similar those stories are. And this guy has a six figure clock, but I wouldn't spend the $3.
Yeah. Either.
His six figures were six digits to the left of the decimal point. Mm-hmm. Mine are typically four to the right of the decimal point. Mm-hmm. So great, you never know what you're going to find out there, though.
Yeah, that's
cool. The next part of this trip, though, they're going to go to Viterbo, Italy, which is 65 miles northwest of Rome, to meet with a Templar expert and author researcher, Gianluca Di Prospero.
That's a great name.
Love it. Sounds like a gladiator, I think. Wasn't there a Prospero gladiator out there? Anyway,
probably.
Could have been.
It's a good, Roman name.
Yes. What is this connection, though, right? Are the Templars connected here? Rick asks. All these symbols in the church that they go into are so interesting. So they go just looking around, right? This town that they're in, though, this Viterbo, was an 8th century temporary headquarters for Pope Alexander IV during some times of unrest in Rome. So it's also a Templar HQ at this time. And it's like a crossroads of the church, the Pope, the Templars. Many travels, many adventures. And there's a church here built in 1080 that they're going to go into and just start looking around for some sign connections.
That'd be cool to go back to 1080 in Viterbo and just walk around and see what was going on.
Well, and I think because of some of the unrest, it did give those around the area, the Templars, a foothold, a leap to power as the Pope sort of moved headquarters there. And I think that also enabled, they took advantage of the opportunity of the unrest and prospered from it.
So, 1080 that this church that they're in here in this episode that they're going around adventuring in, can you imagine if you're living in 1080 in this town and you say, hey, I just heard a few years ago in 1066 this guy William went over and conquered the Britons in England. Like, that's the time frame we're talking about,
right?
William the Conqueror.
That's wild.
Over here in Italy in 1080. Wow.
What a time to be alive then.
You never know.
I don't think many of them were, right? Bring out dead. Yeah. Bring out your dead.
Definitely. Well, this is where Mr. Peter Finetti calls the team over, and he finds the symbol of a cross with the four dots in each quadrant of the cross, right in that space there, which is the same symbol they saw from recorded history on the H.O. stone that was on Oak Island, which I'm so glad Mr. Clotworthy also notes was blowed up on Oak Island by treasure hunters at the time, thinking that there was gold literally on that stone.
How key that would be to have that stone right now.
And I think we're going to break down a little bit layers of those onion, peel off the onion layers a little bit on that H.O. stone, but it's a very quick connection that they're making here.
Yeah, totally. I like the connection, and I'd love to.
For sure.
I'm glad Clotworthy said something that it was blowed up, because I was like, in my mind, I'm like, where is that H.O. stone? Why?
So it's pre-Dunfield, too. He didn't blow it up.
No. It was what they discovered it in 1920, I think.
Oh, I'd have to look it up to verify, but yeah.
And from photos, it looks like there's more to the carving. It does kind of look like there's something else below the H. From the photo that exists. And just imagine if I understand why there's not better records kept. If you're the guy trying to get the buried treasure and you believe in what you're doing, you're not going to want to share this information, but
secrets.
If we had better documentation of all of this, you could so easily, well, maybe not so easily, but you could more easily put the puzzle pieces together and maybe find things, as opposed to not knowing which rabbit hole you're going to go down. And is this little bit of data I am holding on to accurate, or is it a red herring? Is it going in the wrong direction?
Yeah. So,
all part of it's an enigma wrapped up in a mystery inside a riddle.
In a piece of bacon. Gianluca says that
bacon.
There he is. Gianluca, though, does say these dots, right, mark special places by the Templars.
Yeah.
It's also been noted where the shroud is in Turin, Italy. And this is where he got me. The Holy Grail locations from researchers. I didn't see that at all with Indiana Jones and his dad sitting there. I was looking for the signs. So I'm going to keep watching the movie and make sure I didn't miss something from the Grail locations. Alex here comes on in and sees a HIC engraving, letters HIC, Hotel India Charlie, on a column in the church. It could mean here, literally the word here in Latin. And they also notice a Masonic symbol, a compass carved into a column in this church. So this is where Alex starts using his little technology, his little phone tricks here.
Right.
Shows a picture of the HIC and makes it with a few drawing, remind me of Simon. He likes to do drawings, but he turns it into the HO stone. the symbol that we're familiar with. So he's making a big jump here, but it could literally mean here's Templar gold with his.
Right. It's a cool connection. What it's he did.
Right.
But I mean, you have to actually draw that out to make it that theory correct. So I don't know if it's correct, but it is a cool.
It's like if you what took he did the was HIC, cool. took the I and made a cross yep. on it, put the four dots, took the C, completed it to a circle, and then put the dot in the middle, which means gold. So
wouldn't that mean the gold is there then if he thinks it means here is gold?
But he is, there's some artistic license correct. Here, I believe.
There's some artistic yeah. license, but it's like the here, the HIC, and yep. then I think also it's almost like a secret X marks the spot because you're leaving these other Templar signs like the compass and other places, almost saying, hey, if you're a Templar, apply another lens, apply another way to equation. Look at it.
Yep.
Yes, add something on top of what is here. Almost like, you know, I talk about a lot of times in literature when you do different types of literary criticism, feminist lens or the Marxist lens, it's like those Benjamin Franklin glasses in National Treasure.
Yeah.
When you reveal the green, certain stuff pops up. When you reveal the red, certain stuff pops up. And it depends on which lens, which filter you look through. And it's almost as though it's saying, look through a Templar lens, flip yep. down that lens, and viewing it through that frame, you can see HIC here turning into basically the HO stone, but here Templar gold.
Love it.
What's the beer goggle lens?
What you're wearing. That's what you're wearing.
The ones we're wearing right now.
Yes.
Cheers. All
right.
Salud.
So, little theory there that Mr. Alex Lagina comes up with. Kind of interesting.
Interesting. Yeah.
I am curious how much creative license the show took, or did he discover it right then and there? Or was this something that was already kind of in place they had discussed, and then he sees it and then applies it and rolls it out that way? Like how all much of production. It was authentic in this, you know, quote unquote reality television.
And for $1.99, you can buy the app that makes your image the HL right. stone. So no, good theory though. Let's see where this goes.
I liked it.
It was a cool connection.
It really was.
We'll give Alex credit on that one.
Yeah, boys, I like that.
Two more areas here we've got to hit before we leave the Italian job. Lot 5, Jack stops in where Laird Niven is excavating that circular stone feature still. Mr. Robert Clotworthy calls it. So they have an overhead shot in the episode here. It's a big depression, a 13-foot diameter. It matches the money pit again. They like to reference that frequently. Marty pops in for his update. They're standing at the bottom of this depression. They're looking all around at the rocks around them. And, of course, what is it? Laird, it's kind of threw me here, thinks it's a big rock pile that was spread out all around the place.
He's got all sorts of theories. He's known about this for 20 years.
It's just a big rock pile, and they threw it out all over the place. What?
Yeah, I mean, not much going on here on this location in this episode.
Not yet. I think he's going to keep going after it because Dr. Spooner also is going to stop in. When he does, we're going to also see Miriam Amiro and Helen Sheldon hop out of this pit for the review, and they start going into a theory here. But, Jerry, you want to say something about the point here where they're at?
Just that I think it was Indiana Laird did point out that it could have been built over time, added on to one layer done, then another layer, or maybe not a layer is the wrong choice of word there, but
efforts.
Portions of it, yeah.
Yeah, one portion, and then maybe it was indeed used to, whatever, pitch rocks or something. But then it was sort of repurposed maybe a couple of times, which is interesting, right? To if you're on an island and you need something done, maybe you do repurpose something, and you can see how to an archaeologist this might be puzzling. If it was first started off for purpose A, and then someone comes along 100 years later, boom, purpose B, how difficult it would be to attribute what the real reason was. So I do like it. It's confounding and confusing, but I could see how that could happen. Hey, we found this perfect area. Wouldn't this be great for us too? Like,
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a out there theory, but I respect Laird enough to accept his theory on this.
Well, and even spoons, as I think Billy's going to talk about here, right? The maybe the what people used
could be
circular designs for, right?
Scottish castles, they say in this episode, right? And then like an ancient fortification type, and then I think they jump to you could put an artillery piece in this spot and like turn it
like a cannon.
Yeah. Who are we shooting at here from Oak Island?
Not in this time frame. I could certainly see with the Duc d'Anville and at the time of Fort Louisbourg in the 15th century. And
I could do that.
Wait a minute.
Back Fort and Louisburg forth between 1713. England and France. 1713. Sorry.
1713.
So it was the 1600s that it was like falling back and forth between 1640s, 1656 when they had the.
I just want to protect you from those that'll jump in here. And
for sure. I'm getting wrong in my dates. That's my teammate.
Yeah,
my dates are not always 100% as we talk about it, because it's such a fascinating topic, right? Oak Island in and of itself, it brings in all these theories, and here we are. I love our conversations. I hope the audience does too. But as we kind of stumble upon, you know, I feel like we're kind of working out some of the theories and remembering some of these past things that have been brought out and kind of saying, well, what if, and, you know, this circular fortification, of course, they're not going to use it for a rotating cannon in the 10th, 11th, 12th century, but maybe when France and England were battling there in the area, you could see that where they might need a battlement like that.
1745, Louisbourg, Fort falls to the British. So in that time frame, definitely.
Yeah, 1745. Thank you.
You know what? We got to get to the bottom of the swamp before we leave tonight. Craig, Billy, Guptill, Drayton. They are, though, if you see this episode, in the best possible conditions, if you ask me, to go dig in a swamp someday. I want the weather conditions that they have on this day in this episode. It's cold. It's gray. It's misty.
Mucky.
Just a mucky day for
the boots. It's all mucked up.
In a swamp. Man. But as they continue to advance here, they hit a spring, right? And as soon as they start digging, water starts just like pouring out and bubbling away.
They hit a booby trap, one of those box drains.
Man, yes. Jones. Big rocks are turning up here. They're 11 feet down, Mr. Guptill says, but why are these rocks down there? The next day, of course, it's beautiful out. Dr. Spoons is on site, taking a gander at this area. What say you, Dr. Spooner?
Spoons. Please.
And he really just says, it could be a staging area for previous activities. I'm out of here, guys. See ya.
Cool.
Have a good day.
I thought it was like almost in the Fellowship of the Ring when Pippin's throwing stones into that thing and this like underwater sea kraken just comes out and grabs Dr. Spoons by the leg and pulls him underwater. Or when when Han, Laird Solo and Luke Skywalker and Leia are in the trash compactor and Beast pulls Luke down under. I thought something like that was about to happen.
Right. Well, that would have been great because there wasn't a lot going on right there. But
it's not a glacial feature.
I mean, just glacial features, no big deal.
Jeez. You know, I mean, we solved that. It's not a glacial feature.
Thanks. Episode though does wrap up, boys, with Mr. Marty Lagina getting to go underground for his first time ever. So awesome to see. There's still some dirt under his feet there. Overall question is, how close are they to this tunnel? Where would the probes go? We've only got a couple episodes left here. The weather is closing in because our next episode is called Down the Hatch.
Ooh, I like the sounds of that.
And it is the penultimate episode coming up next.
That it is. We're getting down.
Indeed, indeed. I can't wait to get down the hatch on the next one. We got a circular structure that might be the hatch, they say. Maybe an original depository tunnel. We shall find out.
Crown time.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for listening, for interacting with us, especially on Facebook. We're getting a lot of interaction there. That's fantastic. For those of you subscribing, listening to the podcast, we've had a great season. We got two more to go, the penultimate and then the final. Of course, you've been listening to the Oak Island podcast. For my co-hosts, Billy and Mikey, I'm Jer, and we'll catch you next time on the Oak Island podcast.